as you might guess, and the church, which is extremely corrupt, it is corrupt morally, it is corrupt doctrinally, it is corrupt administratively. There's any way in which it's not corrupt. And there was, as you would expect, a rising tide of dissent, and this is not to suggest that there ever was an age without dissent. We have seen glimmers of dissent, have we not? And we're very confident that there was much more dissent, that is objection to this, that we have not seen. In other words, all kinds of people would object, but without doing so formally or officially. Sometimes very dangerous to do so. So do not think that people just accepted this, that there were never thinking people. There always were, but finally it goes too far. And there begins, we're going to trace now, beginning with this discussion, the rising tide of dissent. It's very simple. In the 12th century, we see individual criticism and dissent. Just a particular individual began to speak up. No organized effort. I list here, in summary, the general character of these individuals. They were ahead of their time, first of all, and their criticism, often for the first time, penetrated the area of doctrinal reform. Let me say a word about what doctrinal reform versus administrative reform. It is one thing to criticize the church because of simony, that is, the offices being bought, because the bishops are not doing their job. They are buying bishoprics and not living there, being absent, and to have popes put their illegitimate children in office, and to have money not end up where it's supposed to end up. All kinds of administrative problems. But that's not the same, and there might be moral problems, that is, the priest living with women, the pope committing murder. But that's not the same thing as a doctrinal reform. In other words, it's one thing to say that the church is not efficiently or morally performing its service as the channel of grace through the sacrament. For instance, it might be one thing to say that a priest is not doing his job, therefore you would need administrative reform. It's something else to say that a priest is immoral. He is living with some of the widows in the congregation, in the church. Moral reform. But it's something else altogether to say that the priest does not have the right to absolve people of their sins. See, that's different. And we're going to see that we do not have true reformation until we have doctrinal reform. And for these people, for the first, there was all kinds of call for reform in the area of administration and for moral reform. We already suggested that from Spain already there's coming a hue and a cry. But now we begin to see individuals who not only question how it's done or the moral tone of the church, but they question the very doctrinal structure of the church, and that is something altogether different. We have seen that the mystics got around that, did they not? They simply said it's not important, and they worked from an experience with God. But now you begin to have genuine dissent. So this was the first characteristic, because they were ahead of their time, in that they often penetrated the area of doctrinal reform. Secondly, they came to a tragic end. As you might expect. That's what generally happened to them. Now, list some examples. Peter of Bryce, sometimes called Peter de Bryce, don't translate his name, Peter of Bryce, denied, first of all, that salvation depends on the priesthood. That's doctrinal reform. It doesn't matter if the priest is immoral. It doesn't matter if he was put in office with an under-the-table deal. There's nothing to do with it. Even if he's the most moral man ever lived, and even if he's legitimately has his office, he simply cannot give salvation. He rejected infant baptism and the Eucharist as it was being taught, and he was burned by a mob. A very popular thing to do. probably stirred up by the church. Secondly, Henry of Lausanne died in 1145. He denied the validity of the sacraments when performed by unworthy hands. Heard a little bit of both. He's a little bit of doctrinal and a little bit of moral. He condemned the wealth, power, and corruption of the clergy, and he was sentenced to perpetual imprisonment by the Pope. He died in prison. Arnold of Brescia died in 1155. He was the most important dissenter of the 12th century. You see how we're tracing this? 12th century individual criticism. He is the most important individual. He inflamed Europe and instigated a genuine mass exodus from the churches. He was a firebrand who condemned not only the wealth and corruption and immorality of the papacy, but he denied that the papacy enjoyed temporal power. The Pope is not only corrupt, the papacy is not only corrupt, but the papacy does not have the right to lord it over the state. The Pope does not have temporal power. He offered the separation of church and state. And he was put to death as a common criminal by Frederick Barbarossa. Yes, of the Holy Roman Empire. Well, let's say there was. The question is, why did it take so long? Let me answer that, and of course, this is a good question. First of all, there always was criticism. One of the reasons why you did not find a man like Arnold of Brescia before is that it was very dangerous to be a man like Arnold of Brescia. Look what happened to him. That happened to all the rest of them. And we don't know how many spoke up and were put to death before they could even be heard, before they sort of entered the pages of history. So there were those. Second reason why is that things were really getting bad, and, you know, often it's the principle of the straw which breaks the camel's back. People's up with a lot until things go so far, so long. But third and more important, Inge, is sort of the spirit of the times. Conditions are sort of changing. For instance, we're going to see this later, but it is becoming, whereas before you, under Innocent III, you sort of had universal subservience to the Pope. That isn't true anymore. Now you have nations who are giving lip service to papal supremacy. As a matter of fact, doing pretty much what they want to do. We didn't see that France even kidnapped the papacy. And so, as the church continues to have diminishing authority, they're claiming more and more authority. And this gap between, you know, the more ambitious claims and the decreasing ability to make good these claims would encourage people, would create a situation for dissent, and it would encourage people to do it. And we're going to see this later. For instance, one of the reasons why these men died before they could really get a reform started, if a reform were possible back then. Well, and Martin Luther did not die. He was able, a couple centuries later, to carry on a reform. Was for that reason. These men were dead, maybe other reasons, but certainly we can say that he was alive. He never died a martyr's death. He died in bed. Why? He was protected by his German prince. See, the situation made it possible. We're going to come back to this later. Does that help you understand it? So there always was. There were discouraging factors. Situation kept getting worse, and conditions for dissent kept getting better. But these fellows were ahead of their time, and they died this way. If we come to the 13th century, the era of sects or groups representing dissent as opposed to just individuals. And again, I look at the general character. These were mass movements of uncertain number. They're very hard to trace historically. They were especially strong in southern France. There you are again. Remember southern France, more advanced than the other areas? Perhaps the most culturally advanced and enlightened area of Europe in this age. I've already pointed that out. I guess I give the key to the most notable examples. The Cathari means the pure ones, the cleansed ones, or the Albigenses. And we're going to meet these again later, but The Albigenses, they were named for Albi in southern France, Albigenses, one of their chief sinners. They represented a reaction to corruption, wealth, and immorality, as I point out. They were dualistic and ascetic. They reacted to this extreme, reacted to an extreme system of salvation by works, where everything was, where salvation was physical, where, as one writer put it, by the way, if you want to recommend a book, The Cloister and the Hearth, it's a novel written back in this period, and one of the statements made about how the work of the church is actually carried on, if I can put my finger on it here, the author points out that you talk about a time when a noble was doing his penance, and his penance was to pay so much gold. And he said, well, that was an age when men repented in money. They repented in pennies. That is, you want to do penance, it was every sin had a cash value. And the physical elements of the physical elements of the Eucharist and the holy water and the act of baptism, all these physical acts, ex opere operato, they will do good for you. They'll be efficacious. Well, a dualism sort of gets away from that. It's extremely non-material. You don't see a group like that that's a dualist today in that sense. Look at the Quakers, sort of, and Salvation Army too, by the way. They do away with water baptism altogether, and you're not, you know, physical communion. You don't need the actual loaf and the cup. Sort of reaction against this. Everything becomes spiritual. Although we don't know too much about their doctrine. They organized their own churches, and they were eventually destroyed by a papal crusade. We've already talked about this. I give you the reference. You recall that the Pope simply called a crusade of French nobles from northern France, said, go down and wipe them out, and you can have their land. And by the way, that sort of put an end to southern France as being an enlightened enclave, an enlightened pocket in Europe for a long time. So that was that. That's how they, you know, you understand by papal crusade, he simply did fall upon the Catholic northerners to wipe them out, and pretty much did. The Waldenses were the second group. The remnants of the Waldenses, by the way, survived, as I point out, in northern Italy, making them the oldest Protestant group extant. They joined the Calvinist movement later on, when the Calvinist movement came along, but the Waldenses, through Protestantism, through the Calvinist branch of Protestantism, have enjoyed continuing existence even down to today, the oldest Protestant group. They were named for Peter Waldo, who was a wealthy merchant in Lyon in France, who discovered the Bible. And he said the Bible was not read very much, but he discovered it. And so he had previously committed himself to the mendicant life. He gathered about him a group of disciples, sometimes called the Poor Men of Lyon, or Lyons, if you give the English pronunciation. And they carried on a ministry of preaching, gave away their money, very good men, went around preaching, basic morality. What did they preach? Well, they preached the Ten Commandments and Sermon on the Mount, that approach. A papal commission examined them and forbade them to preach, but they went ahead and preached anyway and set their own churches. They objected to the sacraments, images, indulgences, purgatory, masses for the dead, and so forth. All the elements of lower Christianity, the sacramentals, and got into the more serious doctrinal structure of the church. That is, we have here genuine doctrinal reform. They lived a communal life, and the Pope issued a crusade against them, called for a crusade against them. However, as the Albigenses were wiped out, the Waldenses were not. The reason they could survive in northern Italy is that they headed for the mountains. They were even harried there, persecuted, but they got into the Alps, and it's very difficult to get them out, and they simply as the old saying goes, headed for the hills, and in that way survived. A remnant of them survived. Well, what was the response of the Roman Catholic Church to this criticism and dissent? Well, first of all, and by the way, now you have a situation where the Roman Catholic Church cannot ignore this. First of all, they sent out missionaries to convert them, preachers, primarily the Dominicans. Remember, the Dominicans were a strong order, the military, sort of a papal militia, as I said, and that didn't work. Then they sent out the Crusades, we've already talked about, and that drove it underground or to the hills, but there was still dissent, not just the Albigenses and Waldenses. There were many others, so a lot of it disorganized, unorganized. And so there were people who had been affected by this. There's always a lot of, you take a movement like the Waldenses, there's always more people who sort of buy the ideas but don't formally join the group than there are in the group. And so Pope prohibited the reading of the Bible in France in 1229. By the way, from this time on, it became a general policy in the Roman Catholic Church to discourage the reading of the Bible, in some areas to forbid it. By the way, the Roman Catholic Church has never prohibited the reading of the Bible universally. It has universally discouraged it, but prohibited in some areas. It was prohibited in France, in southern France, or in France, all over France, 1229, and this began the papal policy of discouragement. And by the way, they never discouraged it before. It didn't have to, because the Bible was simply not available. They discouraged it. That is, the discouragement was implicit in the papal, in the Roman Catholic system. They didn't use it, didn't preach it, people didn't have it, and it was not the sole authority anyway. But now they directly, explicitly discouraged it in France. I'm sorry, they prohibited it in France, and from this point on, they actively discouraged the reading of the Bible. Yes. Well, that's one of the reasons given, and it's probably true. Often true. It wasn't true of everybody. It wasn't true of Peter Waldo, for instance. Well, so see the step? First of all, they tried just missionary preaching. That didn't work. Tried the Crusades, and that worked up to a point, but you can only, it's hard to eradicate somebody with a Crusade. Then they put, so that to stop, sort of as a, to also, to stop the growth of these dissenting movements and to prohibit, to inhibit future groups, future movements, they said, well, we saw what happened. Peter Waldo got the reading the Bible, so we'll just forbid the reading of the Bible in France. Well, that didn't, you know, you can't be sure about that. People are going to, hard to, you know, how do you keep people reading the Bible? You can't watch everybody all the time. So it was set up the Inquisition. There had existed an earlier the Episcopal Inquisition, that is, the bishop had the right of inquisition to ferret out and publish heresy in his own diocese. And now this became a papal inquisition, whereas the Pope would do it for the whole church, and it was administered by the Dominicans again. Now, we're going to talk about the Inquisition later, but when we talk about the Counter-Reformation. But anyway, here was the general process. We'll deal with this now. The general process. What was the Inquisition? The famous Inquisition. Hear so much about it? First of all, the Inquisitor would arrive in the community, and all the heretics would be summoned. They would send a crier around. They would announce that all heretics, it would be summoned, and it would be announced that they had 30 days to repent. That's fair, isn't it? You know, they just get the whole month to repent. And if they did, they would be given a comparatively light penance. They could come and confess that they had been reading the Bible and they were questioning the doctrine of the church. And they said, well, I'm sorry now. Okay, and they had the light penance, comparatively light penance, as compared to what they were going to get otherwise, and they were let off. The faithful, and here's one of the real ugly parts of the Inquisition, the faithful were called upon to denounce all heretics to the inquisitors. In other words, they're asked, give us the names of the heretics in the community. Well, you can see what would happen is that if you got an enemy, somebody you don't like, you just put him on the list. The civil authorities were called upon to arrest them. We've seen how this principle works. This was the Pope. Remember the ideals of medieval papacy and This is how it's supposed to work. The state served the church in this way. Only two witnesses, they wouldn't do it with one. You know, they could go going a little bit far if they just have one witness, one accuser. They did require two witnesses to make an accusation. But they didn't have to agree on all points. You get two people to say he's a heretic, well, that's good enough for them. They assume that he was. And by the way, just as in our system, a person innocent until proven guilty, the Inquisition was the other way around. Except that it was almost impossible to prove you were innocent. As it worked out, an accusation was almost the same thing as a conviction. Very few instances it was not. The witnesses might themselves be heretics. And often and this thing spread because people who were accused of being heretics, whether they were or not, would try to get themselves off the hook by accusing someone else. They could be perjurers, murderers, excommunicates, anybody. Once accused, the accused was assumed to be guilty, and trial was by torture aimed at extracting a confession with the view to restoring him to the church after proper punishment. By the way, the theory behind punishment by torture is this, truth invests a person with courage. You torture for asking him a question and torture him. If he's telling the truth, then he will be able to withstand the torture. Truth will give him that strength and courage. If he's not telling the truth, then he will not be able to withstand the torture. That's the theory. But you see, as it worked, because that really isn't true, but as it worked out, generally once they got started, what a person said one way or the other had very little change, almost nothing. That is, I'm not a heretic, I'm not a heretic, and they would torture them. Theoretically, if they held up to the torture and still did not confess to being a heretic, then they weren't a heretic. You understand? The fact that they were telling the truth, that they were not a heretic, would give them the courage to withstand the torture. That's the theory behind it. The problem is they really didn't trust them, even if they didn't change the story, didn't confess, they still didn't trust them. Once they had somebody was accused, by two witnesses at least, they were given a long, uncomfortable imprisonment. Put them in jail for a long time. They didn't get right down to the torture. They only had 30 days grace. Then they would put them in prison, those who were accused without sufficient food. And often this was enough to bring the people around to confessing to being a heretic. The problem is if you confess to being a heretic, you usually got put to death anyway. But you wouldn't be tortured. Yeah, there's no way to win this, really. But often the person would confess. They wouldn't always put them to death. A person would confess if they'd been frozen and starved, kept in isolation in a filthy dungeon for a long time, sometimes several weeks and months. If this didn't bring them around, the trial, if necessary, was held in the presence of clergy and lawyers who were to watch for irregularities. It wasn't a kangaroo court. There was a definite procedure, and they had to have lawyers and clergymen there to make sure everything was done right. The process was recorded by notaries, by the way. Witnesses for the accused were reluctant to testify because they were often themselves accused. This person's not a heretic. Well, why are you saying that? Because you're both heretics. The accused was not allowed to confront those who testified against him. It was very bad. His only defense was, they could do this. Now, they realized it, and it happened all the time. They realized that people, if they had enemies, would simply try to get rid of their enemies by accusing them of heresy when the Inquisition came to town. And so they tried to get around this. They were trying to be fair. The only defense, in other words, if he was accused, he couldn't defend himself. Of course, he was going to deny it. But he was allowed to read a list of his enemies. And if they asked me, I'd name everybody I could think of. And if his accusers' names ended up on that list, they would not get him off the hook, but the court would take into consideration. Didn't automatically get him off. They see, name your enemies. So he, you know, I guess they probably didn't name everybody. Anyway, and so if his accusers, these are his enemies, they would take that in consideration. It probably didn't work too well because people would do that. They would just name everybody. After 1215, the papacy authorized torture for those who would not confess. And this is according to old Roman law, and I've already talked about the theory behind torture, trial by torture. You understand what I mean by that? The theory behind it, that truth gives courage. Well, anyway, the chief means of torture were the rack, the strapado, and the burning coal. The rack, they would strap them on and stretch them. They would put them on, the rack is just that. They would tie them down, and the rack would stretch a person out until it actually pulled the joints apart, pulled out shoulder and hip joints, and very bad. Often they would not go that far. The strapado was devised where they would tie a person's hands behind them and then tie a rope to their wrist and haul them up by a pulley or a tree limb, and they were something high, pull them up, you know, pulling backwards with their hands behind them and pulled up. And then they would ask them to confess. If they would not confess, they would release them, let them fall a distance, and then stop them. A series of jerks, which would dislocate the shoulders, cause terrible pain. And then if they didn't confess, they'd haul them to the top and start them down again. You know, let them fall a few feet and jerk to a sudden stop. That's the strapado. The burning coal, they would build a fire, but you heard this expression, put his feet through the fire. They would strap a person down and build a fire near his feet and move his feet through the fire so that the bottoms of his feet would blister. And then they would let him roast a while, and then they would put a barrier, like a metal piece, down between his feet and the fire to shut off the flame and ask him to confess. If he wouldn't, they would pull it up and let him burn some more. What they did was they were very reluctant to do things to a person that would show visible signs. When they brought these people out to the public, they would put a robe on them, especially to hide, but they would not disfigure the face. They did not want people to think they had been beating up, you know, hurting anybody. So dislocated joint, things like that, it's very hard to see. And of course, the bottoms of the feet did not show when they walked. They would put shoes on them. Later on, they would use a water to force water down there into their stomachs and things like that would not show. If the torture did not extract a confession of guilt, as I point out here, the accused was still assumed guilty until he could explain away the accusations. No-win situation for the most part. Once in a while, somebody got off. Not very often. If the accused abjured, a heavy penance was imposed upon him. That is, if he finally confessed, "I am a heretic," then he would pay a very heavy penance. It would usually ruin him for life. Whereas before, you see that during the 30-day grace period, they could confess and get a light sentence. But here, if they confess, a heavy penance is imposed upon them. Often, they would be put to death anyway. Not always. If he could not explain away the accusations, which is an almost impossible task, and if he failed to confess, he was turned over to the civil authorities for execution. You see, remember I said that the theory was trial by torture, the courage. If he had courage, he would stand up. But if they did stand up, it didn't work because here's where they reasoned. Well, he hasn't confessed. If he had confessed, we could put him to death or fine him heavily and deal with him, but he hasn't confessed. Does that mean he's not a heretic? Well, theoretically, yes, but we can't take the chance. Heretics endanger people's souls. They'll destroy the church. They'll destroy society. We'll just go ahead and put him to death. And the standard method was the burning at the stake. Remember, John Huss was burned by the Council of Constance. The standard method was burning at the stake, burning alive. And the theory was that the justification was, well, if he didn't confess, how do you know he's not burning an innocent man? Well, if he's innocent, God will reward him for his suffering. If he's not, we've gotten rid of a heretic. In any case, the matter is too important to take a chance. It'd be something like this. Now, you say, we think these are, I'm not trying to justify this, I'm trying to help to see it in their own context. What would you do if you had a spy, you had pretty good evidence, or you were pretty well convinced, or at least there was a real possibility, if this spy had in his mind the secrets for that if he gave to the enemy would mean that our total defense system would be useless. What'd you do with him? Suppose you couldn't prove he was guilty. You thought there was a good possibility he had this information and would sell it to the enemy. But you couldn't prove it. What'd you do? Yeah, pardon? Yeah. Well, you'd probably, what governments do, I don't know if our government does this, can't prove it, but what governments do is arrange for them to have an accident. Why? Well, you can't take a chance. And that sounds very inhuman, but you see, what would you do? It's your responsibility, it's your decision.
Would they really feel justified in it?
Oh, yes.
They'd realize they maybe put the death in the hands of man.
Yeah. People didn't live very long that day anyway, you know. Yeah, right. Well, let me talk about the character of the inquisitors. Listen to me. I'm not trying to justify it. I'm trying to help us understand. These inquisitors were not monsters. You talk about the strappado and the burning coals. They sound like monsters to us, and they're very unjust system. You know, of where there's no win. You're guilty until proven innocent, and it's almost impossible to prove you're innocent. But I summarize their characters this way. They were part of a cruel age, and the church was no more or less cruel than the state or society in general. By the way, if things are culturally accepted, they do not seem cruel. We wonder, you got that? If things are, and this kind of thing was accepted. It does not seem cruel if it's culturally accepted. By the way, we look at the Middle Ages, the Inquisitors, and the burning at the stake and the public executions for small crimes, and we think that is horrible. Let me tell you something. They would be even more horrified to know in that day, because they were dominated by church law, they would think that it was nothing what they did. They would be even more horrified to know that in America, 1 million babies a year killed by abortion. They wouldn't do that. See what I mean? Listen, we kill more babies, innocent babies, every year in America than the Inquisition killed in their whole history. You see it all, see what I'm saying? If it's culturally accepted or broadly accepted, it doesn't seem quite so bad. So they were part of a cruel age. The inquisitors believed they were preserving the social order and preventing anarchy and chaos. And by the way, they were. When one of the things that Martin Luther's reform brought about was anarchy, chaos. We're going to read next quarter, say about the terrible wars. The wars that resulted from the division caused by heretics, as they would call heretics, literally destroyed Central Europe. And they knew it would. Third, the inquisitors believed that they were saving the public from eternal suffering in hell. Does that help you understand that as they were, again, I'm not justifying it. We don't like what they did, but they were not evil, slobbering monsters with fangs who wanted nothing but blood. They were godly zealots, products of their age, working in the system as they understood it, and there is a convoluted logic to what they did, is there not? There's a kind of logic there. And we reject this. We object to this. But often, you get treatments of the Inquisition acting like it was some sort of horror show. In many ways, it was, but I think we ought to be fair about it and understand it in its own age, in the context of its own age. You see what I'm getting at? Well, that's a very important question. In the Americas? Not America. One thing was going on with the church. The Catholics were enslaving the Catholic state. The Catholic nations were enslaving the Central and South American Indians and getting gold out. Oh, no, America wasn't settled yet, they say. It was being looted. The settlement was beginning in Central and South America. Just the fringes. No, there's no Inquisition in America. Well,
Do you have any questions on the Inquisition? You see, their problem was that you begin to have heretics, and a heretic is as bad an enemy to the state and to the people's souls. Let me go back to my original now. What would you do if you had the spy you pretty sure was guilty? Or you thought he might be, and he had this information that he could sell would mean that our country would be helpless and defenseless? Add to that, this person had the capability of sending thousands of people to hell for eternity. What'd you do with him? Well, see, and to be fair, the modern Roman Catholic Church decries the Inquisition as much as Protestants do. An ugly period of human history. But it still must be understood in the light of its own age. That's all I'm saying. We come now to critics of the papacy, and the most important one we're going to look at today, critics of the papacy. These are pre-reformers. These are reformers who are ahead of their time also. There was much criticism of the papacy, by the Avignon captivity, by the Great Schism, and in the context of the Avignon captivity, the Babylonian captivity of the Church, when the papacy was nothing more than a bureau of the French government, you want to call it government? It was a puppet of the French king, the Pope was, whoever Pope was in office. In this context, you had the leading pre-Protestant reformers, and the two we're going to talk about are two main ones, John Wycliffe and John Huss. We're going to look at Wycliffe today. We'll begin with Huss tomorrow. Wycliffe, 1320 to 1384. You understand? These are pre-reformers. And by the way, one of the main reasons they are pre-reformers rather than reformers was that conditions did not permit a full Reformation movement. They are not. Wycliffe was just as much a reformer in doctrine as Luther or Calvin. They didn't agree on every point. But you get what I'm saying? Their ideas were no less radical, but you see, sometimes conditions prevent an idea from creating a movement. He was a schoolman, a professor of theology at Oxford. We've already looked at, glanced briefly at the rise of the universities in the later Middle Ages. A leading theologian. He was very influential in one of the leading universities in Europe. He was a statesman. Financial, should read, exactions were a grievous burden to the people in England. England needed protection from the claims of the Pope. Remember, we've already talked about the terrible gold drain from England. Now England, people begin to think of themselves as Englishmen and begin to object to this. Wycliffe developed the concept of stewardship. That is, that the church did not own the land, but rather held it in trust for the people. Interesting theory. In other words, how can we keep this gold from going to Rome without becoming heretics, without denying the faith? He said, well, here's how, let's look at it this way. Let's call it stewardship. The church does not own the land. The church holds it in stewardship for the people. And if it is not used for the people, the church had broken the commitment, and the state or the king had the responsibility of confiscating the lands and taking over the stewardship. Which is exactly what Henry VIII did later on. Interesting theory, isn't it? Therefore, you're not denying God. You're simply saying that the church, that it's a stewardship. And by the way, because of this, he came up with this theory, and the state accepted it. They couldn't augment it right away, couldn't implement it right away. This is one of the reasons that Wycliffe also died in bed. Did not die a heretic's death, although he was clearly a heretic. The state protected him, just like we're going to see the state protected Martin Luther later on. You see that? Remember, Inge, you asked, in answering your question, I got over into the area of conditions right for people to speak up. Well, you see, here you have the state beginning to deny the authority of Rome in a way that they would never have done back in the days of Innocent III. Whereas before, you have a king standing out in the snow, barefooted for 3 days, begging forgiveness. Now you've got kings in England saying, well, let's confiscate the land, let's not send the gold there. A thing they would never have dared to do a few generations earlier. He was a reformer. So he was a statesman.
He was a schoolman. He was an educator. That's where he made his name. He was a statesman. Came up with this theory of stewardship, and England was really grateful for this. They made, it was really a financial boon for them.
He was a reformer. His teachings were genuinely revolutionary, not only in terms of morals, and that was always brought in, but also in terms of doctrine. He affirmed that the church does not exist in the bishops, but in the elect. The church is therefore not coextensive with the state. That is, the church is the people who are really Christians. Very radical idea. Not everyone born in a Christian nation. Christ is the only head of the church, not the Pope. Well, that was radical. The Bible is the only law. Sounds like Alexander Campbell, doesn't it? Not canon law and traditions. Wycliffe sought to make the Bible available to all men. Wycliffe considered the Pope the Antichrist, not the vicar of Christ. See, Martin Luther was to say this later. Here Wycliffe said it before the Protestant Reformation. And in England, he created a great deal of hatred for the papacy. And later, Henry VIII, when the break did not come until later, after John Wycliffe is dead. But one of the reasons, and this is looking ahead now, one of the reasons Henry VIII could pull off his break with England, break with Rome, was that the crop sold by Wycliffe was bearing fruit. Wycliffe and others created a lot of popular support for the idea that the Pope had no right to dominate English religion and English politics. Y'all see that? Well, he created a lot of hatred for the papacy. Wycliffe attacked monasticism, mendicancy, celibacy, indulgences, saint worship, transubstantiation, right on down the line. Sounds like Arnold of Brescia, doesn't it? But you see, Arnold didn't was put to death, and Wycliffe wasn't. Although his movement was a pre-Reformation movement. The major contributions of Wycliffe, the translation and distribution of the scriptures. Wycliffe said it was his goal that the poor English boy walking behind the plow would have a Bible and would be able to read it. By the way, we owe much to Wycliffe, and we owe much of the fact that we have an English Bible to John Wycliffe. He's truly a great man. He had many disciples, followers, and they were called the Lollards, or the poor preachers. They would travel around and preach, and they would preach basic morality. Again, they would preach like the Ten Commandments, the Sermon on the Mount, basic morality. A simple relationship to Christ. To summarize the career and death of Wycliffe, he lost his position at Oxford. It was an official church college. He ended his days as the director of a small parish. By the way, he was happier there. He became a preacher in a local parish and did much of his writing there, and that's where he ended his days. He was allowed to die in bed. Later on, we're going to see that the church dug up his bones and burned them as a heretic, although he was already dead, but they didn't get to him here. He was protected by the state because of his earlier service. I've already mentioned this, allowed to die peacefully. The Pope sent out word to do him in, and the state said no. Why? So they were grateful because he had furnished this theory of stewardship, which enabled them to solve, which helped to solve a real problem that they had. What was the reaction to Wycliffe? Well, I've already suggested it here. In 1414, the Council of Constance this is the same council, by the way. It went on from 1414 to about 1418. You follow me? It was one council that had different. They would meet for part of the year, then go home and come back and meet. That's how these councils work. They don't all meet at one time. The Council of Constance. Remember that burned John Huss? The Council of Constance prohibited the reading of the English scripture under pain of excommunication. Same thing they'd done in France. Remember that the Albigenses and the Waldenses, the Pope said you can't read the Bible, did the same thing in England. Can't read the English, but not only can you not read the Vulgate, can't read the English scriptures, which Wycliffe had produced. Under pain of excommunication, forfeiture of lands, cattle, goods, and life for the self and heirs forever. And further translations were forbidden. In 1415, the Council of Constance condemned Wycliffe on 250 counts. Well, he's dead now, you see, but they condemned him. Ordered his writings burned.
and his bones exhumed and removed from consecrated ground. He was buried in a churchyard, church cemetery. All cemeteries were church cemeteries, by the way. The bones were disinterred, burned to ashes. Why burn them? See, burning was the standard punishment for a heretic, and the fact that he was dead was too bad. They're sorry he was dead in that sense, but it was a symbolic act. But by burning his bones, skeleton, they were simply saying it was a public announcement that this man was a heretic. Therefore, even though he's dead, his ideas and actions were heretical. They're not to be condoned. Y'all see that? Then they were cast into the little river Swift,